Hello, Guitar Smarts listeners. This is an important announcement. Please don't skip ahead. We start this podcast with a special message. Way back in 2021, Guitar Smarts had the pleasure of interviewing the utterly fantastic Matt Long. Matt is a multiple award-winning British blues guitarist and lead singer of the British blues band Catfish and hard rock outfit The Revenant Ones. He joined us for episode number 20 and was a truly gracious guest who spoke about his career, his childhood, guitars, and meeting his hero, Joe Bonamassa. Well, Matt needs your help. Through 2023, Matt has been undergoing treatment for bowel cancer, and his recent prognosis has meant that to extend his life and retain a chance of survival, he needs to seek private treatment outside of the NHS. Matt's family have set up a GoFundMe page that is linked in the Guitar Smarts link tree in the description of this podcast, and we at the Guitar Smarts podcast would like to invite each and every listener to consider donating towards this fund that could well save the life of one of the brightest guitar talents of our generation. Now is the time, folks. Head on over to the link in the description to find the GoFundMe page. Donate what you can. Your donation could save a life. Thank you. Enjoy the podcast. And he said, in short, my contract with Gibson was up, Carlton tells me. And the truth is, the ES-335 model by Gibson is pretty inconsistent. You have to be careful about them. They're very different from my 69, which was frustrating. I remember going to Europe and playing versions by other companies, which inspired the idea with Sire. Long story short, Carlton continues, the beauty of the whole thing with Sire is the greater attention to detail. Imagine saying that about Sire compared to Gibson. Greetings, welcome back to the Guitar Smarts podcast. We are once again back with you for another episode. Thanks as always for listening in. This week we discuss the meteoric rise of the brand Sire, whose star has been lifted by Marcus Miller and Larry Carlton, two of music's most revered ever session musicians. But what is it about Sire guitars that are turning the heads of these guys? Commercial interests aside, there has to be something about these guitars worth looking into. But is it also exacerbated by a decline in the quality of instruments produced by the bigger and older names in the business? Let's discuss it. Come and tell us what you think in the comments on our social media pages. As always, remember to like and subscribe to this podcast. This way you won't miss the next show. Use the link tree in the description of the show to get to our social media pages, especially the Guitar Geek Hangout page on Facebook, where you can get to know many other guitar nerds just like us. Have a great couple of weeks. Remember, if you've got any comments or requests for the show, you can reach out to us through our social media pages. That's about enough from me. Let's get to it. Hey, Kieran, it's been weeks. How long has it actually been since we spoke?
Forgive me, Father, it has been at least 5 weeks since our last guitar confessional, I believe.
The guitar confessional. That's actually a good idea for another podcast.
Yeah, it really is. Or at least an episode. What would we confess?
I don't know. That's a good point. That you really want to park a fly?
I kind of do, because
actually, so do I.
It's probably going to become one of those revered guitars.
It is, isn't it? Yeah. It probably is. I was looking at them on eBay, and they're like, some people are asking for like £2,000-3,000 Parker flies. It's crazy.
How much were they originally?
Probably about £2,000-3,000.
All right, okay.
Probably quite a lot.
Yeah, quite a lot of money. Exactly. There's a lot of carbon fibre in them, isn't there?
Yeah, exactly. But anyway, what's happened? Since we last spoke? What's been going on in gigging. Your life, guitar wise?
Gigging, which has been wonderful. Awesome. Yeah, we had a couple of weeks break, and then May was full of gigs, which was wonderful. Just been out. We played some interesting ones, some pub stuff, some private parties. Just having fun and enjoying gigging and loving my rig. Just loving my rig, man. There's nothing. I'm in a way that makes me feel slightly uncomfortable because I've stopped like questing for more pedals and tweaking stuff and trying to I don't know. I mean, I can tell by the look on your face, you know this is only transient and surely cannot last. But I'm feeling deeply satisfied with everything in my rig. It just does what I need it to do consistently and dependably. I'm obviously going to blow a valve now, and so I'll turn my amp on at my next gig and the whole thing will just turn into a smoking wreck. But all my last few gigs with this pedal board lineup, this amp, this guitar, it's just working for me in every way, to the point where I'm like, I'm done. I'm not buying anything else. I don't need to. This is it. For this band, awesome. For this lineup, for this music, this is it.
So which is the number one guitar then for this?
At the moment, the Gold Top. The Gold Top Eye. Yeah, so I've been gigging for the last year, the Tobacco Burst-ish one.
Yeah.
Which, if you've seen our social media feeds and stuff, I often take pictures of my guitars and stuff at gigs. And I love that one. I love it deeply. But I felt the Gold Top was neglected.
Okay.
And hadn't really been properly. So for the last few gigs, I've left the Tobacco one at home and I've just taken the Gold Top. And I must say, it's a different beast, considering it's the same model of guitar. I mean, this is not a revelation. Guitars are individual, even if they're the same model. But it's got a slightly different neck profile. It's got a slightly different weight. It's got different pickups in it.
Mm-hmm.
And they are very different. And I EQ things differently, and the pedals are set up differently. But it just, yeah. As the kids would say, my friend, it's a whole vibe.
It's a whole vibe.
I don't feel comfortable saying that. Yeah, it's a vibe. No, I'm too old to say that. I've made myself feel slightly sick saying that.
I love the way you said that and then just immediately capitulated into, I don't feel comfortable speaking
No, I don't.
I totally get it. That's why I laughed so hard.
It sounded okay in my head and then it came out and I was like, no, that's not me. It just works. It just really works. And if anything, there's a bit more of a fight, not a fight. A fight is the wrong word. There's a little bit more of a nuance to this guitar and the pickups and how I use the tone controls. But the sounds are all there and it's a bit more guttural. So the difference between, I mean, cause I rewired both of these, right? They've both got the same orange drop capacitors in it, the same CTS pots, the same cloth wiring, all that's been done. They've had, you know, a lovely setup done on them. They're effectively the same model guitar in different finishes, albeit slightly different weights, slightly different neck profile. That's just like manufacturing tolerance differences, not anything specifically different. So the main difference is really the pickups. So the Tobacco one has got the, all-time revered Seymour Duncan hot-rodded humbucker set, which is allegedly Seymour Duncan's number one selling pickup set, which is the jazz pickup in the neck and the Jeff Beck.
The JB
in the bridge, which I tried in Les Pauls before and I found didn't work for me personally. I found the jazz pickup very nice, very mellow, very smooth, pretty versatile, but does what a Les Paul neck pickup should do. But I found that Jeff Beck pickup too harsh and bright in Les Pauls that I'd used it in before, but in this one it works like a dream and it's balanced.
Awesome.
and it's great. So it works. But the Gold Top has got these Iron Gear Tesla Sharks, which are effectively a identical copy of the Seymour Duncan Alnico 2 / pickups.
Yeah.
And I have both. I have the original / Seymour Duncan ones in another Les Paul. And the Iron Gear copies in this Tokai, they are the same. Tonally, output, construction, they're an identical copy. You cannot tell the difference.
Interesting.
So yeah, I'm enjoying this. So I fear I'm over caffeinated because you asked one question and then I unraveled it into a monologue of 10 minutes. So I apologize. But,
No. Hey, it's good because. No, I'm genuinely interested because it is fascinating when you make these comparisons between not just different models of pickups, but like, it makes such a difference in your playing experience, just the slightest of things.
Mm.
You know, if there's anything that I've learned over time is that you sometimes think you can make a compromise in your kind of guitar tone, and you can. You know, I'm very much happy that I know I can get a a satisfactory guitar sound out of, you know, some basic gears, even some cheap stuff. And I don't really feel like I have to have, you know, kind of boutique everything to get the tone I want. And I sometimes think that you know, the chase to get certain tones and certain things, and it's got to be this guitar and this thing, I think is a little bit, you know, cork sniffery, you know, like I've said before. It's a little bit kind of, but it is still strange how chasing, you know, chasing tone and kind of making the slightest change can change your experience in playing music. And I think also where I kind of envy you in a way is that you're in a band where you're the only guitarist and you get to have this freedom of exploring your sound and developing it over time and making it work for the band and still having fun with it. So I kind of, you know, I'm living vicariously through you. So over-caffeinated or not, Kieran, it's absolutely acceptable.
You're kind. I saw this post which made me think the other day on Facebook, and I forget if it was on the Guitar Geek Hangout or another guitar website, well, not website, but group on Facebook. And at first I read it and I thought, yeah, good point. And then I reflected on it and I thought, I'm not sure I agree or not. So, and forgive me, I forget the name of the individual that put this post on there, but they said something to the words of, with all of the kind of EQing potential on amps and, you know, this plethora of pedals, be it, you know, modeled pedals or, you know, traditional stomp box pedals, you know, really, is there any merit in us modding our guitars and getting obsessed with, you know, the types of tone capacitors and wiring and I think more importantly, pickups, they were saying, when all of it is surely EQable from your pedals and your amp, and just get on and play. Don't worry about, you know, having the latest, you know, pickups, expensive pickups in there, or don't stress about having to swap pickups out and AB them for all these marginal gains that you might perceive are achievable. A pickup is a pickup to some extent, and you can EQ what you want it to sound like through your pedal board and through your amp in any case. And I kind of read it and I went, yeah, fair point, probably right. But then as I reflected on it, I kind of thought what you just mentioned about kind of refining your tone in the same band setting week on week, and my comment that I just made about this rig just kind of is consistently doing it for me. I think is the difference between an easy life and a pleasurable playing experience, and the comment that Facebooker made, which isn't, there's nothing wrong with that comment at all. It's a particularly valid conversation starter. But for me, the pickups that I've got in this guitar, not particularly expensive, but in this rig, in this setting, consistently week on week, irrespective of the venue, give me that sound and playing experience that I want. And I've, like you, I've gigged for many years and there are times where I've been frustrated with my rig, not because I couldn't get it to sound like how I wanted it to sound, but I couldn't get it to consistently perform in the way that I wanted it to. And then at every gig, it would be like, oh, damn it, it doesn't sound as good as the last gig, or, oh, it sounds better than the last gig. How have I done that? What's happened? What's the difference? And of course, some of that is room acoustics, speaker placement, you know, room dimensions, all of that. But I'm just finding with this rig and this pedal board and this setup and this guitar, it's more consistent every time because I know how these bits perform. And, you know, in answer to what that Facebooker kind of posted, these pickups get me quicker to the sound that I'm looking for in my head and more consistently because I don't have to spend time trying to EQ it every time. It's already 95% of the way there every time I plug it in, as are the pedals, as are the EQ settings that I know I get on my amp, and I just have to tweak things marginally and it's there, and that just makes my life easier.
Yeah. I think it's the, sometimes it's also like the accumulative effects of time and experience sometimes as well, isn't it? That you become more accustomed to getting closer to what you like until you eventually get to a point where you can hit that consistently. And I also think sometimes if you kind of, like you just said, you know, previously sometimes you'd experienced, you know, having a good sound at some gigs and then other gigs maybe struggling with it. And you know, and you said it could be the room. Well, I wonder sometimes if really your sound is always like that, but that some rooms reveal it to you more than others. You know what I mean? Like some rooms could be quite flattering to your guitar tone, especially, you know, if the stage is a particular way, you know, acoustically the room kind of is forgiving, then, you know, you can kind of feel good about your tone. And actually on those gigs where you kind of like, I don't know what's wrong with it today, it doesn't feel the same. It's actually no different, but you just, it's just certain frequencies pop out more than others.
You're right.
And if you can, if you've honed your tone down to what you've got now, then it's just that that happens less frequently because you've got it to a, such a place where it's less affected by those rooms.
So this is a really good point. This is a point very well made, right? And it's true in the hi-fi kind of world as well, which I dabble in, and constant cork sniffery and snake oil, to use your terminology, exists even more so in that vein as it does in guitar circles. But I've been using the wireless Line 6 kit that I've had for years, but I've been using it more often now on gigs. In fact, I use it almost exclusively on all gigs now. It's very rarely I just go straight in with a cable now, because I again this Line 6 wireless stuff, I've got the G50, which is now probably coming up for, got to be almost 2 decades old, maybe not that old, 15 years old maybe, and it's bulletproof. It's just lasted. I've said that now, so it'll explode at my next gig. But what it's allowed me to do is properly walk around the room during sound check, and even for those kind of first couple of numbers, as you know, the room's filled up and you're trying to get a sense of it. And again, what I've seen with this rig, which is making me say the things that I'm saying, is the sound that I hear in different parts of the room is more consistently like the sound that I hear when I'm stood right in front of the back line as well, which again is one of those frustration points oftentimes when you're playing in a live situation and you go, okay, I'm set up, I'm sound checked, I'm doing my sound check, and then you walk out front and it's a totally different sound. Mm-hmm. Like the highs are completely different, the low end's changed, the mid range is different, the level of perceived like kind of sustain on your notes is different, the distortions sound different, and you just go, well, how the hell do I make this sound right? Because I want it to be a good experience where I'm standing, but I also want the audience to have a decent sound as well. And you know, that's irrespective of miking up your amp and running it through the PA and all of that. And again, what I found in this instance is I'll get my sound that I want from the back line. It gets mic'd up and put through the front of house anyway. But when I walk out and listen to the sound right in the room, yes, of course it's different and that varies from gig to gig, but it only allows me to make subtle tweaks. And then it's just like there, it's dialed in. And I'm like, I know I'm getting a good sound out front and I know it's going to sound good for me from where I'm. So yeah, maybe it's just experience. Maybe it's just my ears are completely knackered after 30 years of standing next to a drummer. Who knows?
You've lost all that high end out of your hearing now. So that's exactly what's happening.
Is that what it is?
Yeah.
I've become happier as my hearing has degraded. That's probably it. What it is. It's got nothing to do.
Smoother than this, yes, because you can't hear any high end anymore.
Can't hear anything anymore.
That's it. That's what's happening.
That's probably it.
Anyway, look, let's talk about. I really want to talk to you this week about Larry Carlton and Sire Guitars. Sorry to interrupt this conversation. However, if you're a regular listener, then you should definitely come and join us on our Facebook group, the Guitar Geek Hangout. Go and join the Guitar Geek Hangout on Facebook now before you carry on with the podcast. I'll wait here. Hey, welcome back.
I'm excited about these.
Again. I haven't played one yet. And obviously, no. I know some guys who play, you know, one of my closest friends, Owen, who's a bass guitarist and an excellent guitarist as well, plays some is it Marcus Miller?
Bassist.
You know, Rory Harvey, who's an old friend, someone we both know, we've had him on the show before, he plays. I hit some of those guitars too. Fantastic basses. And obviously over the last few years, they've been producing some really nice electric guitars as well. And acoustics.
Acoustics. Really nice. Mike Dawes did some great demos of their acoustics, didn't he?
Absolutely. But there's been some There's been some features recently on YouTube. I know Tim Pierce has done a video about Larry Carlton's comments recently, and and the quality of his signature guitars. This is interesting because about 3 or 4 months ago, I noticed on YouTube that Corey Wong did a live performance online as part of his kind of YouTube TV series he did, and Larry Carlton came on. And it was the first time I'd seen Larry Carlton come and do a performance with a Sire guitar instead of using his. I mean, this, you know, he's, other than a period through the 80s where he also played some Valley Arts guitar, he's obviously been renowned for decades for playing his same 69 Gibson 335. But I've noticed him playing his Sire signature more. And I was reading this guitar. I don't know if you've read the Guitar World interview he's just done recently.
Oh, I haven't.
But Andrew Daly, who's the journalist who spoke to Larry Carlton for this interview, asked him. He said, "Why have you put your vintage guitars down in favor of these budget friendly Sire models?" And he said, "In short, my contract with Gibson was up," Carlton tells me, "and the truth is the ES-335 model by Gibson is pretty inconsistent. You have to be careful about them. They're very different from my 69, which was frustrating. I remember going to Europe and playing versions by other companies, which inspired the idea with Sire. Long story short," Carlton continues, "Sire approached me and it seemed like the perfect time for me to make the move. The beauty of the whole thing with Sire is the greater attention to detail." Imagine saying that about Sire compared to Gibson. When they approached me, they gave me 7 guitars made in Korea for me to evaluate before we met. And I have to say, the quality was just unbelievable. Ultimately, I wanted to provide a guitar to people at a reasonable price to match the larger brand's quality. So it's quite astounding to hear that from him. I mean, that's somebody who's historically been uncompromising in what he wants to achieve and what instrument, he uses. So to say that, to basically say, I mean, if it was just a commercial venture, I'm sure he would say, "Well, I really like what these guys are doing. I wanted to do something, but he's been very vocal about his dissatisfaction with Gibson.
That's interesting because people don't normally put their head above the parapet in that way, right? I've not read this article yet. Obviously, I'm as you know, getting excited about this particular model of guitar, having followed the Sire kind of product catalog for a couple of years now, going, "Oh, that looks nice. That looks nice." I got really excited about the acoustics when they came out. But this thing just looks. I watched the Tim Pierce video on it. I mean, Tim Pierce is someone that I think is just a phenomenal legend. An incredible player, but what I like about his reviews is he's very straight talking. He's very open and honest about it. He doesn't really seem to have to offer up a lot of the company's marketing spiel. He kind of tells it as it is, and he's saying this thing is phenomenal, right? And it's not a paid promotion. He's been given a guitar by, I think it was Sweetwater or something, to demo, but then give away to his listening audience. So it's not, I mean, obviously, there's probably some conflict of interest somewhere, but I trust his opinion. But moreover, I trust my ears and trust what this looks like. And it looks and sounds phenomenal. I mean, the fact that Larry Carlton is basically one of the most respected session guitarists that ever was has put his name to it. You just go, whoa, okay, so hold on a minute. He's willing to put his name to this. So, for Sire, amazing, right? They've got one of the best session guitarists that's ever been with a signature guitar now. But yet these guitars, obviously made in the Far East, which, we're a fan of, as well as the, American made and, wherever it's made guitars, we hold no prejudice. But this is a 335 killer that's selling for effectively a quarter of its price.
Yeah,
that you would expect from it for Gibson. So I think they're retailing for like $800-$700 in the US. You can get them here in the UK for £500-£600. That's mind blowing.
It really is mind blowing. I mean, that's the crazy thing for me. It's priced to compete against Epiphone,
right?
But it stands up against Gibson. And there's two conversations there for me, which is, how on earth are Sire doing things that well at that price? And one, and two, how on earth are Gibson letting themselves down in such a way. Do you know what I mean? It's like there's two sides to that story, I think. You have to give a huge credit to not just Sire, but Epiphone. And there's some other brands out there that are doing fantastic things around that price range.
Mm.
You know, even some big brands that are kind of reaching down. You know, PRS have always done it well with the SE range. They've been able to still give something really great to that kind of sub-$1,000, sub-£1,000 bracket of guitars. Fender have done it well. Fender still have great guitars in that range that are Fender, not just Squire. But I don't understand why Gibson allow this conversation to happen. I find it frustrating, but I don't know whether that's because, you know, we forget how tumultuous a time it's been for Gibson over the last 10 years, having gone through, you know, bankruptcy and then restructuring management. They've just changed the CEO again recently to a guy who was, I think, head of product development or something. Who knows how things will change at Gibson? Every guitar company's gone through this. Fender went through this with the CBS buyout. So, you know how I feel about Gibson. I've pontificated about that too many times now, you know. But, you know, if you're going to charge, if you're going to start at over £3,000 for something like a 335, that even one of your historically most relevant players is Larry Carlton, says he can get something just as good now for $700. You're doing something wrong with your guitars. You just are. You're just not. I think you've probably rested a little bit on your laurels for too long and not offered something that's really justifiable. I mean, even like I noticed recently in a picture of the Foo Fighters when they, you know, announced their new drummer and they've been doing these videos, rehearsals online, that, you know, Dave Grohl was playing, I think, an Epiphone version of his signature guitar. I'm not saying that's relevant in this conversation, but I think Gibson need to pull the socks up a little bit, I think. But all credit to Sire for obviously producing these amazing guitars. We've got to go and try them out, for sure.
We really do. Well, they're available in the UK and they're in stock now. and I haven't been this excited about a guitar for a while now. Why is it that I'm excited? Well, I love the 335 shape and vibe of the 335 anyway. But I think it's because they've hit an incredible balance of quality and price point, which gets me excited about it and makes me think, oh, well, this is maybe something that I would be looking to purchase because I've got a bunch of nice guitars. I don't really need any more. So anything that I buy has got to be kind of justified. So me going out and spending several thousands of pounds now on another 335 just because I like 335s doesn't make cost-effective economical sense to me. And probably, as I've said on a number of times on this podcast, not something that a weekend warrior like me is going to take out to the pub for a gig. It's just not a sensible thing for me to do. Whereas a £500-£600 335 that looks and sounds like this, I'd be very happy to take it out and play it and not stress about it, especially if it's as good as it, you know, people are professing it is. So that's why I'm excited about it. I love a good guitar at a good price, but how are they doing it? You know, we've talked about this before. This is economies of scale and labor costs at producing stuff in the Far East. But what's more exciting is that year on year, Matt, we talk about how the quality notches up and yet the prices don't in the same way, right? They're priced this incredibly competitively. The guitar building experience and quality control keeps going up and up exponentially, it would seem. It hasn't appeared to plateau in the Far East. Some would say they've been doing great guitars for years. I agree. But the consistency of them doing great guitars across a number of different factories now in the Far East seems to be reaching this, you know, incredible, you know, point for players who want more affordable instruments. And on the flip side of that, you've commented about the difficult position that Gibson are in, right? They're trading on a heritage. They've got higher labor costs. They've got a traditional way of doing things and manufacturing things, but they've also got a company that's not arguably been best managed for a number of years. And I don't think it's anything controversial to say that people often comment that their quality control is not what it needs to be. Now, maybe that's because people are less forgiving of any tiny flaw because of how expensive those guitars are, right? Maybe if you had those same flaws on a guitar that cost a quarter of the price, you'd forgive them and just go, well, you know, it's only a guitar that costs X amount. So a little bit of, you know, dodgy fretwork here and there, or a little bit of kind of inconsistency in setup and things like that, you quite happily forgive. But I know people always like to share bad news rather than share good news, but my feed on social media is often filled with people commenting and taking photographs of new Gibsons they've had delivered and pointing out like the quality control issues on them.
Seriously?
And Oh, yeah. I see it on a like weekly basis, right? I'll forward you some of the recent ones. And these aren't little quality control issues where you go, okay, do you know what? This is people a bit disgruntled, understandably so, because they've spent multiple thousands of pounds or dollars on a Gibson guitar and actually it's got a little issue with it. Maybe get over yourself, or, you know, get it fixed. Some of these issues are like glaring issues, like raised frets that aren't properly seated. One guy shared a post the other day of a guitar which had like two or three visible thumbprints underneath the nitrocellulose lacquer where the finish was just contaminated. And that, you know, that's there forever now. You can't get that out. You're like, well, how on earth is that past quality control? You know, such glaring issues with bits of the guitar. So I don't think they're making life easy for the reputation, because if you're going to charge that much money, if you're going to produce your guitars in that way, in the traditional way that people arguably do want, because that's what comes with Gibson, you've got to get the quality control right every time. Otherwise you're damaging your brand value, and people just go, they're not worth it. They're just not worth it. When I now have alternatives. We didn't used to have alternatives. When you and I were teenagers growing up aspiring to buy guitars, we had Epiphone, but that was it.
Yeah. That
was pretty much it. Anything else was cheap and nasty.
Yeah.
Now that's not the case. It's not the case at all now.
Are you sure it wasn't a Murphy Lab thumbprint? It wasn't like wasn't like Tom Murphy's thumb.
Maybe he's like he's doing like they did with in Jurassic Park, right, with the mosquito in amber. It's like, so in generations to come, somebody can go, well, this is Tom Murphy's DNA embedded in this actual guitar, and we will find a way to clone Tom Murphy from the fingerprint he's left in the finish.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you mentioned about, like, you know, the you know, it's obviously the consistent in their inconsistency. You know, you're seeing evidence in that. There was an interesting video on YouTube a couple of months back from Ben Crowe, you know, of Crimson Guitars, where video was, I think the title of the video was Gibson Aren't Making Their Guitars Properly or something.
Yeah,
like
I watched that one. Yeah, that? I watched it. Yeah.
I don't know. You might be able to explain the what he was talking about better than me, or somebody like Big Ray, you know, hey, Ray, hope you're well. We'll probably understand it better, because he was speaking very detail fashion about the tenon joint into them, and how the angle of the neck is kind of achieved through the luthery process, you know, and getting that joint were and how that tenon should be shaved, or, you know, an angle in such a way so as it meets the body completely flat, that angle is correct, you know. I think that's basically what he was saying.
Exactly.
Is that
right?
Is that right? So obviously certain things need to be done then. So for example, the neck, I think he was saying, needs to go onto the body before the fretboard to correct. Be able to achieve that angle correct. Right, because as it's, but he said that he's pretty certain Gibson are making the necks and completing the fretboard before they attach them to the body.
They are. No, they do now. They absolutely do.
And then regardless of whether that tenon meets the body perfectly or not, like in a flat angle, they're setting the angle that it needs to be. And therefore, he said he looked inside one of the guitar in the pickup cavity, he could see
that
there was a clear gap between the body and the neck, because the neck wasn't made correctly to maintain the right angle. And he said, correct. That's just clear. He said people in, you know, like Gibson's family of luthiers would be rolling in their graves. You know, people in the late 50s would have taken very, very, you know, very much time and effort to make sure those things were done properly, because they were proper luthiers. And it was an interesting video, because it was a clear indictment of that quality control issue, not just in the basic things of finishing a guitar and, you know, like thumbprints in the lacquer or cracks and, you know, blemishes and things like that. This is down to the very basics of how that guitar and those Gibson guitars should be constructed. And the you know, it seems like they're turning a blind eye to how that's being done. And I got to be honest, I don't think I'd go near a modern day Gibson. you know, right now. Not for the money they are, and knowing, you know, that, so much is slipping through the net in terms of quality control.
Yeah.
I'd spend my money on six sires or, you know, every Epiphone you can
buy. I was playing my Tokai the other day while my wife was chatting to me in this room, as I often do. Annoys her deeply when I'm needling away while she's trying to talk at me. She does, she loves my guitar playing and supports me tirelessly, but there's nothing.
You have no idea what she said, do you?
No, of course not. And deliberately so. No, of course I do, because I'm multitasking. But anyway, during one of those episodes where I was trying to listen and noodle away, I politely interrupted her mid-flow and just said, "Do you know what? This is one of the best guitars that I've ever bought." And I said, "Honestly, just amazing." And that is a Tokai. It's just awesome. It's got that thing that which you do get when you play a proper Gibson with a nitrocellulose lacquer and the construction methods and all of that, where they just resonate acoustically beautifully. And you seldom get that in the heavy polyurethane finished Far Eastern guitars. Does it make any difference when you plug them in? Topic for another day. But these Tokais, even the way they've done the polyurethane finish on them, it's not nitro, but it's thin, it's sympathetic, it's not this horrible thick coat of it. It resonates in the same way. I'm just like, this is the future. It's like, and the reason I say this is because I said those exact words you just mentioned in the next sentence, which was, don't think I'll be buying another Gibson anytime in my life. Don't think I will. I don't think there's a need to.
I wonder if it's the same with their acoustics, though, because I love their acoustics. Like, you know, I've always really loved the idea of having a J200, you know.
Yeah, that's a big guitar.
A big guitar. I tried one out in New York once.
Oh, yes, you did, didn't you? You told me. Yeah, oh, yeah, you told me it was a religious experience.
It was all, yeah, exactly. It was, I can't remember which guitar store it was. It was up near Times Square. It wasn't the Sam Ash place. It was a different, beautiful guitar store. And I was looking at it for a while, just thinking, this is beautiful, absolutely beautiful, you know, like custom shop, J200, not the standard. It had a ridiculous price tag on it. And a guy came up and said, "Do you want to play it?" I said to him, "There's no way I'm buying it." I said, "I can't afford it. I would hate for you to think that this is a possible sale." And he said, "I don't care." He said, "If you want to play it, play it. You might never get the chance again." Play guitar as nice as that. And I sat down for probably about 10 minutes and barely played anything else than, you know, A and E. But every, you know, I feel like every note had, you know, the sound of every kind of song I'd ever played or listened to in it. It was just the most resonant, beautiful, and just awesome sounding instrument. I didn't spot any thumbprints in the lacquer because I was too busy enjoying E and
well, there
A.
You go.
But it was incredible. And I think, you know, their acoustic instruments are still fantastic. I've always liked the J200s, the J45s. I think they sound great. You know, it's the sound of Americana to me is a, you know, a really nice Gibson acoustic guitar. I'd still like to try them out. But yeah, they're electrics. They're letting themselves down. Maybe we'll see a resurgence under this new CEO over the coming years. Let's see.
I still love them. I'm still a massive Gibson fanboy, as much as the bashing that we give them. I'm a huge Gibson fanboy, but I just want them to be value for money and worth it. And
exactly.
And without the issues. Well, yeah. Anyway,
even
let's go and try.
Sorry, just a quick one. Even Kirk Hammett recently has said of all the greeny guitars that have come out,
his is the best. no shit, Kirk.
Because isn't there an Epiphone version? Is there an Epiphone version?
Oh, good question. I think there is.
I think there is. I'm pretty certain there is an Epiphone version of the greeny. I don't know. Anyway, but he said, I think he said he prefers the cheaper one. Which is really? Telling. But anyway,
we're going to have to fact check this.
Let's move on from that. Yeah. You have to fact check. I could be wrong. I'm going to. What were you going to say? Sorry, mate.
I don't know. I'm more interested in this now because if this is true, it's a revelation. Let's
Kirk
fact
Hammett's,
check.
Yeah, I'm going to just check Kirk Hammett's favorite, not Metallica song.
Wah pedal.
Say the one with the wah pedal. Yeah.
Google would just autocomplete every sentence. Kirk Hammett's favorite wah pedal.
Oh dear. I don't know. I,
anyway.
Kirk Hammett, this is it, Music Radar. Yeah, my favourite version of the Green is probably the Epiphone. Ooh. Metallica guitarist suggests the best is yet to come for the legacy of the Les Paul and explains why. The Gibson USAs are great, but my favourite version of Green is probably the Epiphone. The Epiphone Green is just by themselves, sound great, play great, and I was amazed at how I was playing an Epiphone and didn't want to put it down. It's just on all levels. This was 2 or 3 weeks ago. The Epiphone Green is now my couch guitar, and I reach for it when I'm watching TV. Okay.
Do you believe that?
I don't know.
I don't know if I believe that.
I don't know if he... Yeah, I mean, it's Kirk Hammett, isn't it? It's not... He's not.
Well, no dissing Kirk or anything, but there's a huge media, like, press office behind all of this statements, and it's just like... I mean, from a marketing perspective.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, they're going to sell the Gibson ones out anyway. Gibson sell guitars, and people buy their guitars. Right. And so somebody that wants a Greeny... that's got the money for the Gibson one will pay for the Gibson one, right? And then they've got to sell the Epiphone one as well, right? And so what every Epiphone owner always wants to know, because this is what I wanted to know when I owned an Epiphone, was it every bit as good as a Gibson?
Yeah.
So,
but not just that. I guess also what's key here is you want the person who plays the Gibson who influences you to kind of vindicate it for you, that it's okay to also get the Epiphone.
Correct.
That's what John Bonamassa does every year. We've got every Epiphone it is.
Absolutely.
Bloody well releases.
And absolutely.
Then, so, I mean, he has also said, he said, I guess I'm most excited about that Epiphone, because it makes the Greeny mythology, the Greeny influence, the Greeny inspiration available to everyone.
Available to the masses. Yeah, it's like this. You could substitute that sentence for every guitar Epiphone has ever put a press release out about, especially a signature one.
Absolutely.
I'm pretty sure that. Yeah. Anyway, I'm not calling bullshit on it, but I'm just saying.
Yeah.
It's yeah. Who knows? Let's go and try one of those as well.
We've got to try one out. Got to try one out for sure.
Tell you what is exciting, other than this Larry Carlton 87 335.
Yeah.
It's not a 335, is it? It's an 87 for all intents and purposes. Is you sent me something which I've been desperately waiting for. I don't know why. But PRS and the Silver Sky SE, new colors.
Maple necks, maple fretboards, sorry. New colors. Yeah, absolutely. And how are you feeling about the new colours, Karen?
It was funny.
Better than I am.
Well, you sent it through to me. And this shows you how fickle I am and the roller coaster of things that happen in my brain in the space of 2 minutes. I clicked on it and my heart raced and I got all excited and I went, oh, yes, they've done it. They've done what I wanted, which is they've put the SE, which I think obviously it was... We highly anticipated guitar, ended up to sell as one of the highest selling guitars of last year, deservedly so. Mm. But I was always disappointed with the colours that they released, the PRS too. Silver Sky SE. And I was just like, those colours are just not right. I just don't, none of them appeal to me particularly. So they finally released a bunch of colours that I actually personally like all of them and think they're great. But then my roller coaster was... Oh yeah, but I tried one of those and I still was a bit underwhelmed. So I probably still wouldn't buy one, but nice colours. But I don't know. Again, this shows you how fickle I am. Now I'm looking at them and they're new colours. I'm going, oh, maybe I'll go and try one of them again now because it looks nicer.
I would quite like to try the maple fretboard versions because I do think the Silver Sky is a prettier guitar with a maple fretboard. But then again, that's because I'm a Clapton fan and... For me, a Strat is, you know, even though my Strat's a rosewood fretboard, I would like a maple fretboard. But do you know what? The thing that disappoints me with it is, you know, the guitars that this Silver Sky SE is competing with, right? It's Fender's player range of guitars. The Fender Player and Player Plus. And have you seen the colours you can get?
Any colours.
Guitars?
Anything you want.
Oh, my God. The colour options you've got in that series of Fender guitars is just, it's like... You know, the PRS guitar SEs might as well just be in black and white.
Yeah.
It's just, if you're going to make the colour of your guitar a selling point, at least make it comparable in terms of the excitement value of it as the guitars you're competing against.
Yeah.
That's just the way I feel about it. It just doesn't seem like something to get excited about.
Well, they were trying to with the PRS colours, as much as everything else resembled a Strat. They were trying to then, I guess, make a bolder statement and departure and be a bit more innovative in the finish ranges. Mm. And although you pointed this out to me, copying car colours for your guitar is not that innovative, and Fender were doing that back in the day.
Well, car colours Leo Fender could buy. He could buy
his paint, yeah.
Paint that could be sprayed. You know, tends to be sold to car companies who sprayed cars. So he was getting colours. So when John Mayer came out and said, "This is the colour of Tesla, that's interesting and cool," I was like, "Well, no, that's exactly what Fender were doing in the 50s.
Mm.
You're not doing any different now other than using a car from modern time, you know."
That's it. Maybe Elon Musk was round the table in the Wood Library cellar sipping on bourbon with them, going, "Paint them my car colours."
Do you like
the colours though? Do you like these new colours or not?
Meh.
Oh, really? Not a fan?
Not that bothered. Having said that, I've never really been overly bothered about guitar colours anyway, except for, you know, the Clapton Strat colour, you know, because when Clapton brought, you know, Fender and Clapton brought out those Clapton Strats in the 80s.
Mm.
There was four colours and five colours, I think. You could get black, which is obviously a standard colour, and you could get Olympic white, which is really cream.
Mm-hmm.
That was a standard colour. But then there were three custom colours. There was 7-Up green, entirely new colour. There was Torino red.
Right.
Which was a Ferrari colour. That was a pair. But they'd obviously, Fender have had Candy Apple red. They'd had a Fiesta red.
Fiesta red, maybe some other reds,
but Torino.
Red was one of the first colours, I think, that they did the Strat, because the black Strat that we all know and love, that didn't come out until much later, actually.
No,
black Strats were really rare back in the day.
Obviously, the Sunburst, but that's because furniture was tend to be sold around the time of Sunburst.
True.
So the Clapton Strat came out with 7-Up green, Torino red, and pewter as well, obviously. And the pewter one is the one that I like dream of. I just love that. It's like three-dimensional, you know, and it makes it look cool. And then later in the 90s, they did a Mercedes blue, which I think you can still get. You know, these are colours chosen by Clapton, some of his favourite things. You know, the Torino red is the Ferrari red. But those are the only colours I've ever really been... I mean, they're not particularly interesting, but 7-Up green?
I mean, that's
awesome. Have you ever seen 7-Up green Strat?
No, I haven't. I haven't.
Oh, God. I mean, I'm
going to... I'm going straight to Google now. I didn't even know there was a... I mean, I know what 7-Up is, but I had no idea there was a 7-Up green
Strat. I've only ever seen
him
playing it once, which was late 80s. It was... It was...
Oh, yeah. Oh, wow.
Yeah, and he played it... there's a great picture of him playing it in a purple suit, looking like Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. I think it was like Saturday Night Live. He did Old Love, and Robert Cray played with him in the US. It was like late 80s, and he used the 7-Up green Strat.
Nice.
The concert he did with like Phil Collins in the mid 80s with Nathan East and Greg Fillinganes, he used the Torino red. Obviously, when he did From the Cradle, he was using the Olympic white. He's used all of them that he's done, these interesting colours. But for me, I like that Strat at the time was like, even though it's Clapton and he's known for playing these vintage Strats or this mongrel vintage Strat, when his new guitar came out, he was kind of like the John Mayer of the time, and he had these interesting colours. But I don't feel inspired by the PRS SE colours at all, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But anyway.
I thought you would have liked the grey looking.
It kind of looks like primer in a way, you know, like it's not got that thing.
Yeah, you know? I hear you. It's a thick colour. Oh, well, there we go. Let's go. We'll have to go and try some of those.
Let's
out
do
and
it.
See.
Let's get it in the diary. We need to go and do a Guitar Smarts. I've been saying this for two bloody years. Let's get it sorted out, mate. Come on.
Yeah.
Let's do it. Yeah. Let's get in, you know, in June or July, we need to get out there and get playing some of these guitars that we've been talking about for so long, the Sires, the PRS SEs,
the
Murphy Labs.
Absolutely.
You know. Let's go and get
ourselves. We made it to the jam night, so we can make it to the guitar store.
Cool. Well, any gigs coming up this week, Matt?
No, I don't think so. No, I've got a weekend free this weekend, which is great. I'm chilling this weekend, but I've got a couple of guitars being dropped off to me. Actually, one arrived yesterday and then another one this afternoon. So I've got some setup stuff to do this weekend. But yeah, no gigs this weekend. So yeah, I've had a string of them. So it's nice to have a weekend off.
Absolutely.
How about you, mate? What are you doing this weekend, guitar-wise?
Probably just a little bit of practice, I think. I've got a wedding gig coming up in a couple of weeks, so I'll start getting a bit of practicing for that. Other than that, nothing really. Just going to chill out.
Pleasure, mate. Pleasure. Well, look, enjoy your weekend. We'll catch up soon. But yes, let's. I really want us to go and try some of these Sire guitars now. So I think that's the next thing is we'll come back and we'll tell people what we actually thought of it in real life.
Let's do it, mate. Let's get it organised. Anyway, have a good rest of your day, buddy. I will speak to you soon.
Yeah, cheers, Matt. Take care.
All the best, Matt.
Thanks so much for listening. If you like what you hear, then why not give the rest of our shows a good listen too? And if you love our podcast and you're a regular listener who wants to support the show even more, then consider buying us a coffee over on our Buy Me a Coffee page. Anyway, best wishes. See you next time on the Guitar Smarts podcast.